Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernor.
We're coming to you on Geeks of Doom, as we do every week. This week, we're going to get into some of the impending legal and copyright minefields associated with the untamed frontier that is desktop 3D printing. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I'd like to talk about a couple of things. First of all, I did get the new iPhone 5. Yeah, I got it.
Congratulations on your new baby.
Yay!
I'll send you a present.
That's terrific. So I've been playing with it for about half a week now, and it is relatively... relatively speaking, in relation to the iPhone 4, incredibly lighter
than.
I mean, it is like scary how light this is.
Did you have
a
4
so
or 4S,
Andy? Speed boost for you.
What's that?
Did you have a 4 or a 4S?
I had the 4.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And
that's
a
big jump.
A nice speed boost, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just all around great. I finally got Siri, which is nice. And
oh, you hadn't had Siri before. Of course, you're on the 4 before.
Yeah.
Right. The panorama camera thing is nice. I don't know if it works quite as accurately as some standalone apps for panorama apps.
I haven't used that. Is that only on the 5?
It's...
That's on any iOS 6. It's. I think the 4 and the 4S should be able to use it. The 4S definitely does.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Oh, there it is. Panorama.
It wasn't because I updated my 4 to iOS 6, and Panorama wasn't on that. So I think it may only be on the.
No, well, the 4S
it's
definitely
on the 4S.
Has.
It's on the 4S.
And
sure.
But it's not on the iPad.
Don't think so. No. Although, stop taking photos with your iPads, seriously. I just want to smack every single person.
Every single
who
Japanese
holds up their tablet
you ever seen in New York.
I was at the Monterey Aquarium recently, and I saw like people just wandering around with tablets. Like, apparently, tablets are the new thing to bring to the aquarium, like, and take pictures. And I don't know why you need to look at
They're
a screen
not
through a screen.
Computers.
Well, it's easier to walk around with your tablet looking through it than it is with your phone looking through it, because your tablet's got so much more pixels. If you got an iPad, especially an iPad 3,
I prefer to look through my eyes. Well, usually my glasses.
Yeah, less screen, more eye space.
But I, in general, I love it. I love the, there's like all the things that we talked about over the last few weeks, all the, advantages to both the iPhone 5 and iOS 6 and the combination of the two I am in love with. I can't really think of many, the only sort of drawbacks are not really device related. Like, I hate the fact that I have to get a whole bunch of new cables now for, wherever I want to plug this in.
That's device related. That's defined as device related.
It's an ecosystem related thing, because before you could have people around, you know, everybody who had an iPhone would have a charger. Now you don't even have that failsafe, so it's kind of a pain.
It'll take a year.
You know, it kind of boggles me that people are so up in arms about the chain. We didn't talk about that as much when it came out. Like,
why does that boggle you? This makes perfect sense to me.
Well, I understand why people are. So I guess I understand both sides. Like, I understand why. Like, you know, people are annoyed. But at the same time, I mean, that's a 10-year-old cable.
Yeah,
design.
It needs to die. It does.
It needed to be updated. At some point, you have to update. You can't keep the old stuff forever because, you know, it just happens to be compatible with everything. I mean, remember the 90s when it was like, oh, it's Visa. Oh, now it's USB. Oh, now it's USB 2. Oh, now it's DVI.
I mean, USB 2 has been around forever, Chris.
Right, right.
Yeah,
but, it's like, but it wasn't. If we didn't upgrade to USB from SCSI or something, it's like...
Yeah, exactly. At some point, you have to do it.
I don't know when micro USB came out. I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I'm mostly playing devil's advocate. Obviously, I know why the change had to happen, all that stuff. But I do think that one of the big issues here was that Apple is known for ease. It's known for simplicity and all these things like that. And it's been a while since they've kind of gone through a wholesale change. Like the big OS X change back in the day, it threw a lot of old you know, like legacy users back, and they were like, oh man, I'm so turned off or whatever. Or when they got rid of all their stuff in Mac OS 9 when the iMac first came out, and they got rid of all their all the legacy ports, it was only USB or whatever. Many people were turned off by that because their peripherals didn't work. This isn't something to be shocked at. It's just something to it's just something to understand. Yeah. If they want to push forward, they're going to have to change standards. But we can't, as geeks especially, we can't walk around all highfalutin saying, oh, I don't understand why people are so upset. It's a 10-year-old standard. It's just something we have to explain because people are like, I have 45 cables that I have in every single facet of my life. Now I only have one.
I'm more curious, Dwayne, why the geeks are complaining. Because you should know why we're upgrading.
These are the same geeks that spend $400 every 2 years to buy a new iPhone.
Or every year, actually.
Or every year to buy a new iPhone. Yeah, exactly. I don't hear the regular people complaining.
Big deal with the iPhone, to be honest. One of the things about, another thing about the iPhone, specifically the iPhone, is that because every single iPhone had the same dock or whatever, or they make like the same one for 2 years, one of the reasons why it's difficult for me to think about an Android phone at this point isn't just because of the apps and everything. It's because as I look at what I want to use my phone for, I know that I can find – like I have three separate cases. I have a battery case. I have an OtterBox for skiing. I have a battery case for when I want to travel. And I've got the everyday like case that's less bulky than all the ones but is really good for like bouncing if I drop my phone on the floor. And why do I have all those options? Because there's so much stuff that's standard about it. This represents a big change in the way that people dock their devices in their vehicles, that people, you know, dock their devices to their iHome that they've had since 2009 or 2007, ever since the API came out to be able to use like that sort of dock interface or whatever. Hell, I just bought a Vizio a wireless headset that has an iPhone dock in it, and that, you know, that won't work unless I use the adapter, which actually sticks up above everything, so it probably won't work at all. Sure. My point is that people have invested in the form factor, and I think they're a little disappointed that what Apple has delivered is a little less accommodating than it possibly could have been.
I mean, I understand those concerns, but at the same time, they're basically advocating for no change ever, so all their old shit can always work, so that's kind of a pain.
All right. Okay. So the other thing that I checked out this week was How the West Was Won, which is a movie from 1962 in three strip cinerama. And the reason that I bring this up.
Nice.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. The reason I bring this up in this show is because it's an example of an obsolete legacy film technology that really was the forerunner to IMAX. Now, the way Cinerama worked is it was shot with three interlocked 35mm cameras with 27mm lenses, and they were spread out across a 146-degree arc and then projected from three synchronized 35mm projectors onto a deep, curved screen. And they shot about 10 features that way. Before they shifted to what they called a single film Cinerama, which is actually a branded version of Ultra Panavision 70. Mm-hmm. There's only two theaters in the whole world that can currently exhibit true Cinerama pictures, and that's the Cinerama Hollywood, ArcLight Cinerama here in Hollywood, and a Cinerama Dome in Seattle that happens to be owned by Paul Allen from Microsoft, founder of Microsoft. So this is a terrific movie if you've never seen it before. It's basically follows four generations of a family as they move westward from New York to the Pacific Ocean by way of riverboats, wagon trains, and eventually trains, the migration of people from trains to California. It won three Academy Awards, Best Screenplay, Best Editing, Best Sound. And just seeing it in this presentation, this three-strip cinerama presentation, is phenomenal. I mean, there are some some showcase pieces in this movie. They have, there's a buffalo stampede, a train robbery, Indian battles, and just it's just a terrific experience to see this legacy, you know, technology that would eventually go away. I mean, basically the problem with the format was the reason that one of the reasons that it went away is first of all the complication of shooting it things that way, but a good part of that was that aesthetically it was hard for to frame compositions for the right. format. Like because you're dealing with three different panels, a lot of times you couldn't have any close-ups, because if you had any close-ups, the person's screen would be spread across the three panels, and there's always this slightly noticeable seams on either third on the thirds of the screen where you can see where the projectors are joining up. So what usually happens is the directors would compose the frame so that they'd stick everybody in the middle, and then you'd have this kind of empty vista on either side, or you'd have somebody on the left and the right, and the way the camera was positioned, they had to kind of cheat their eye line so that they weren't really looking at each other. And when you sit down in the curved screen, the effect is supposed to be that that they're looking like they're looking at each other's eye lines, but mm-hmm. you can really tell that they're not really looking at each other. So it was a flawed process.
I wonder, like, the thought process behind creating that. Was that, like, so was 70 millimeter around when Cinerama was around?
No, it hadn't really. I mean, this was pre-Ultra Panavision.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, every time you see one of these technologies in film, at least 9 times out of 10, it's always to address a slump in the market. Like, you know, they're trying to get people back into the theaters because of one reason or another. And I think in this case, it was probably television still. You know, people weren't in the theaters enough. So they're trying to bring some sort of experience, theatrical experience, that cannot be duplicated in home video. And ironically enough, if you buy this film on Blu-ray now, it's a better presentation. First of all, there's one disc that has two different versions of the movie, and one is a better transfer where you don't see the seams at all. It's completely seamless. They've done that, like, they've digitally altered it and done it in post-production. And the other presentation is this kind of forced, what they call smile box technology, where the edges are curved to simulate the Cinerama experience.
That's terrible.
Yeah. But it was a great movie. I loved it, and I really enjoyed the experience.
It sounds like that sort of the technology almost drove the art in that case, forcing you to take certain types of camera angles, sort of define the genre. It's kind of cool sometimes, like. This is more a statement, I think, of art than of technology, but, like, limitations on what you can do produce oftentimes more interesting art than when you have sort of free reign to do anything. Because if you can do anything, it's sort of like, well, I don't know, I'll just do what I always do. Whereas when you have something that forces you to not do what you always do, it, like, forces you out to, like, do something just, like, totally different.
Sometimes. Yeah, in this case, I don't think it.
Also look at Twitter and look at, like, things we've seen now that have gotten popular. It's all about, like, simplicity, I think, in a way. Kind of removing these or giving people restrictions, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Devendra, what have you been playing with this week?
Well, actually, a couple things. But since you brought up movies, Andy, I wanted to quickly talk about MoviePass, which is ridiculously cool and sort of relaunched this week. So this is a service. It's been around for a while. Have you guys heard of it?
I've not heard of this.
Okay, so it's been like a monthly subscription service where you would basically be able to see one movie a day for free for paying like $30 to $40 a month or something. But before, you had to like pick a movie online, print out this like ticket voucher, take it to the movie theater, and kind of hope that you still have a seat, because it also doesn't reserve you a seat. This week they launched something ridiculously cool. So they have a new mobile app plus a new prepaid card. So now if you want to see a movie with MoviePass, you just have to like go to the theater, check in to the movie that you're going to see. That sends the ticket funds to your card. Mm-hmm. Then you just buy a ticket at the booth. So by doing this, it can work with any movie theater anything that accepts credit cards, which is like all of them at this point, most of them. And they didn't have to do deals with the studios or the theaters. I'm sure they're pissed, but I think this is ridiculously cool. So if you like movies, if you're going to watch like at least, you know, if you watch 4 or 5 movies in a month, this is probably going to pay for itself. And yeah, they're starting off the trial beta right now. It's going to be like $25 to $40 depending on where you live. But it's really
That's
cool.
Cheap.
It's
for 4 to 5 movies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also, yeah, for 4 to 5, but you could use it every single day of the month. Like, nothing is stopping you. You get one free movie a day. So that's
how
they're
affording to get in the ticket. How are they affording to?
So there's all sorts of other stuff they're doing. I think, well, first of all, people are actually paying for this. And as with all subscription plans, they're assuming most people aren't going to be doing it every day. So they're going to make money from, you know, the people who aren't using the service too much. But there is potential down the line for them to, like, partner with theaters to like work with their loyalty programs or something. So when you check in with MoviePass, like you can earn, I don't know, Lowe's points or something. So there is that potential there. Yeah, that sort of thing. So I just think it's ridiculously cool. Really innovative too. Like it's a big leap forward for them. So movie fans, people listening to this show and who listen to me in the / Filmcast should definitely check it out. I think it's worth testing if you can get into the beta. So there's that. Definitely super cool. Also played with the Kindle Paperwhite, which I got on Monday. And I did, you know what? I almost forgot I ordered this thing. I pre-ordered it when it when they went up in early September. I was like, you know, I don't really like the Kindle Touch very much, so I'll just go for something better and give away the Kindle Touch. This thing is actually really, really nice. It feels about the same weight as the Kindle Touch, the last year's model, but the design just feels a lot better. It feels like the newer Kindle Fire, so it's sleeker. Feels a little more refined. The screen is really nice. It's 60% more resolution for the text, so you don't see some of the scraggly lines you used to. And the light is actually pretty amazing. I was really impressed with it because it's so good you don't even want to turn it off when you're in a bright room. Like it actually adds this nice almost pearlescent layer to the screen, which is probably why they called it paper white. So now it's like you're watching a perfectly lit like page on a book rather than like a slightly gray e-ink screen or something. So even with the light on,
you can read it without
could turn off the light altogether, but I'm saying the experience with just leaving the light on even in a bright room is actually pretty good, and you can still get 8 weeks of battery life with that. So yeah, it may cause tech people to go to like freak out and say like you're wasting battery life. Ultimately, not a huge deal. It looks really good. You kind of have to see it in person. So I really like what they did here. And also, the touch response is so much better. I hated about last year's model was that the e-ink wasn't fast enough to keep up with touch response. So like typing on the keyboard, selecting books and stuff, it was just way too slow. Now it's almost real time. So it's not as fast as like, you know, a capacitive touchscreen, but it's almost there. You can actually type multiple letters at once. It feels almost like a tablet now. So if you've been waiting on a new Kindle, definitely go for this one. But I think orders aren't going to be shipped until next month, so you'll have to wait a bit.
Yeah, I ordered one earlier, but obviously not early enough. I've got it coming in like late October.
Oh, I'd be interested to know when exactly you ordered, because Amazon only updated their thing, their shipping like expectation thing, like this week, like Tuesday. So, and now it's saying 4 to 6 weeks. So if you order it today, you'll definitely have to wait till November or something. Yeah. Briefly, one more thing I want to complain about: Microsoft's keyboard and mice. This is just kind of random, but I tested out Microsoft's newest desktop keyboard this week, Surface something or other. It's their newest desktop keyboard. The interesting claim to fame is that it has a split spacebar design. I think I talked about this before. Weirdly, it actually just, the spacebar thing is vaguely interesting, but it just feels weird to type with. The actual angle of the keys has changed. And I can't do it. I couldn't use it for more than a couple hours. And at that same point, I was using the Microsoft Touch mouse, that one that just has a fully like multi-touch surface on the front. I've been using that for a couple of weeks, and I realized, you know what? I hate this thing. I don't need to use this thing
anymore. Is it because you change too many things at once?
No, I don't know. Like I think I could withstand the touch mouse and some of the things I had to deal with. But when I realized the keyboard itself sucked too, I was like, you know what? I'm done. I'm done with you, Microsoft. I'm done with your peripherals. So I went and I ordered the latest Logitech wireless keyboard and mouse, the K100 illuminated keyboard, the Performance MX mouse. I'm very happy. Logitech just seems to get this stuff mm-hmm. now. I mean, they were kind of the pioneers in wireless peripherals for a while,
sure.
but it's even mm-hmm. so much clearer here. I think the Touch Mouse itself, even though it's been improved since it was released, I think 2 years ago, it's just, we don't use mice like that. You don't want a fully touch-sensitive surface where mm-hmm. your fingers are, because your fingers are always moving, guys. Mm-hmm. You kind of need a mechanical thing to scroll pages and move back
and forth.
Yeah,
why are people afraid of
Windows?
Buttons? Mm-hmm. Why are people afraid of buttons?
I think like Microsoft thinks, you know,
tactile. You're not looking at your hands. Yeah. Your hands are just supposed to know.
Well, you can also like they assume, okay, we're just gonna eventually move towards gestures on our mice or something. But it's just either we've been trained to use our mice in a certain way, mm-hmm. or it's just really weird to have touch surfaces on your mice. Having a full thing like that
at the same time. That's the weird
part. Are they
part.
Trying to copy the Apple design of not having a button?
I mean, sorta. It did. The Microsoft Touch Mouse does have two vaguely separate portions for left and right click, but I think it does look like a single piece. It's a little more interesting in what they're trying to do than Apple's, but I think the execution is probably even worse because there are all these commands. There's like, if I flick my thumb a certain way, it'll go back in the web page. So it has some really interesting things, but it has some really stupid things. Like there's no middle click button. There's no third mouse button. It's impossible to do.
You can't, usually on those mice, if there's no middle click, you can hold down both buttons. But since it's all like Apple's mouse, you can't do that because it doesn't know that two fingers are down always when you press. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And the same with some of these other ones.
It's a little painful, this transition we're looking at.
I think companies are experimenting, trying to put touch in these things. I just don't think it works. I think for people like us who are kind of used to desktops and working with, you know, normal sized computers, the traditional mouse is going to stick around for a while. And also this keyboard I'm using is very nice too. It's just very nice feeling.
Well, it's not broken. The traditional mouse isn't broken. They're like when you're on like a trackpad and there's some great like gestures you can do, whether it's Apple's or Synaptics, the kind of stuff that you find on like, you know, an HP or a Samsung. There's some cool stuff there. But it's not cool enough to make you completely abandon the mouse when you need super precision.
Yeah.
And that's really what's up.
Yeah, the new Logitech mouse just feels a lot more precise. The Microsoft Touch Mouse was just always kind of floaty. Like, it didn't sit right on my desk in ways. Mm-hmm. And just moving it around was not as accurate as, like, moving around even my old Logitech Revolution wireless mouse. So anyway... Mm-hmm. Don't buy Microsoft peripherals anymore. That's basically what I'm saying.
That's kind of sad because, I mean, they've really made some of the best peripherals for a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. Yeah,
dude, the IntelliMouse 3 has got to be the greatest mouse I've ever played with until the greatest wired mouse I've ever used was the Microsoft IntelliMouse 3. It was
the IntelliMouse Explorer, right?
Yeah. IntelliMouse Explorer. That, like, it was the best wired mouse I used. It was astounding. It like led the optical technology. It led all that stuff. And the only thing that changed was the fact that the newer mice, you know, they came wireless, and those were all pretty shitty until the MX700 showed up for Logitech.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really intimate devices. One last thing I want to say about this.
Oh, sure, sure.
They're so intimate, like just like how your phone is your most intimate device now, because it's partly because you're touching it. You're doing all this stuff with your fingers. You're feeling it. That's why glass matters and metal matters and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. When you're on your mouse or your keyboard or your trackball, if you're Andy. Yeah. part
judge.
Of it's like it's the tactile response. You need to be like a pilot in like an airship, not even an airplane, but like an airship, like moving levers, flipping switches, holding buttons without having to look at anything. And that's kind of where some of this touch stuff goes awry. It doesn't have that tactile intuitiveness that we've come to expect from our computing experience.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some of the headlines here. Facebook on Thursday unveiled GIFs, a major initiative into the world of social gift giving and e-commerce. Users can choose, mail, and pay for real-world physical gifts, not just virtual ones, as Facebook offered a few years ago, to send to one another, all completely inside of Facebook. They're tied to the significant event reminders that pop up on occasion, say a friend's anniversary or birthday. Or even better for Facebook, users can just buy gifts for the heck of it. So they're joining with over 100 retail partners at launch, from which users can choose gifts to send to another. Starbucks is far and away the biggest launch partner. Users can send gifts to their friends, who will then receive a notification via phone and desktop that there's a present waiting. After the gift is received and accepted, the sender receives a notification in return. I think something like this would really kickstart their mobile initiative, Facebook's mobile initiative. What do you guys think?
Yeah, that's really kind of a cool sort of breakdown. I mean, Facebook is in a position with their mobile to sort of break down the sort of online offline distinction that we've had. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of cool. I mean, they've been so much about like bringing your in-life identity online that it's refreshing to see them move in the opposite direction and move towards, you know, taking the utility that you get out of Facebook and improving your offline interactions. You know, sending offline somebody an anniversary.
Offline is the key to digital commerce, I think. Being able to completely track your online to offline interactions is really where the whole interactive aspect of the internet needs to go if we want to see real value out of these companies, like real physical value. So I think what Chris is saying is absolutely correct. The fact that Facebook's able to find the logistics train to pull off like the giving, dispensing of offline hard physical gifts is kind of astounding. I'm really proud of what they're trying to do here.
It'll be really interesting to see sort of exactly how it works, because it does need to be like beautiful and simple. It needs to be like very much not half-assed, because you can already buy things.
Yeah, I mean, Chris is saying you can already buy things in the meat space.
And you can already buy stuff easily on your phone. It needs to be like just super easy to do it from within there. I mean, one thing I think that
Amazon's figured it out, which is kind of cool, but they're the only ones, really.
Yeah. They need to figure out a way to sort of get people to give them their credit cards, because once they have those credit cards, then they can just sort of start selling other things and using Facebook for something else.
Dude, this is what I was talking about years ago when they started these gifts, and they were like the $1 gift. All it was a ploy to get your credit card. So eventually when they had other products, they could be like, oh, we already have your card. It's easy. It's the Amazon way, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So they didn't actually do it. They just sort of sat on it.
Yeah, they weren't able to pull it off. But, I mean, other companies, a Kickstarter, how has it been so successful? You go through Amazon payments like nobody's business, right? Like,
yeah.
It's just that simple. And unlike PayPal, it's not tied directly to your bank. It's tied to a credit card, which means that you can make these purchases that are not small. You can make these purchases that are not small, you know, via a card that gives you something in return. So there's something to that, too. Mm-hmm. Which is why PayPal integration, I think, hasn't taken off as much as many people, you know, believed it would. One, there's real money. It really is. It's actually your bank account. Who knows what's happening there? And then two, you're not getting those points.
All right. Moving on. Last week, Apple chief executive Tim Cook issued a public apology for the company's buggy Maps application on iOS 6. He admits that the Apple fell short in providing the best possible experience with its maps. Let me read a quote from his email here. As time progressed, we wanted to provide our customers with even better maps, including features such as turn-by-turn directions, voice integrations, flyover, vector-based maps. And in order to do this, we had to create a version of maps from the ground up. He says, the more our customers use our maps, the better it will get, and we greatly appreciate the feedback we received from you. And then he says, while we're improving maps, you can try alternatives by downloading map apps from the App Store like Bing, MapQuest, and Waze, or use Google or Nokia Maps by going to the websites and creating an icon of their home screen. So he's recommending other brands, other services.
Well, not even that. He's recommending, web apps, not just like other native apps. One, he's recommending web apps, and Apple opened up a maps alternative section of the App Store. Mm-hmm. So in the categories, you can look for navigation now, and here are alternatives to their maps. That wasn't necessary before because their maps were what's up. I mean, I wrote you guys this in an email, and I put it on my my blog at flavors.me, but frankly, they had two choices here. One was to pull the software and put together a magical experience working between Yelp and TomTom and all these people to make the best cohesive, you know, cogent map experience possible. Or they could give it a shot, do something similar, and make sure it really worked. It really, really worked for a year or however long their agreement was with Google before rolling it out again. And I feel like that's where they missed the mark. they didn't QA this. They didn't look at it specifically. This wasn't Apple quality because people didn't notice. It fell through the cracks. People didn't notice how different the experience was and that difference was not a true upgrade. And I really feel like throwing in that veneer of turn-by-turn navigation, 3D, flyover, it's all a veneer to the fact that the data isn't as good. So much so that they changed their website to say it's this might they used to say this might be the most beautiful mapping application ever.
Right. And powerful.
You know, because they couldn't make that. That was a puffery claim that could sit there.
They couldn't say it anymore, Yeah.
It's just funny.
I have to admit, though, I really admire what Tim Cook, how he handled it, though. And it reminded me a lot of Steve Jobs' reaction to Applegate. You know,
Does it?
I'm sorry, really? Not Applegate. AntennaGate. Yeah, because he came out. Well, not his initial.
Reaction. It took a lot longer. So I think this is actually a really good example of how Tim Cook is so different than Steve Jobs, right? Because Tim Cook apologized within a few days.
Yeah.
First of all, AntennaGate took a couple of weeks. Steve Jobs also famously, remember, there were all those emails.
You're holding it wrong.
You're doing it wrong. Tim Cook never blamed the user, which I find to be kind of, that's pretty commendable. So and then, he's outright saying, hey, you know what? We kind of screwed up. Here are some alternatives until we get it right. That's a pretty calm response to all this, whereas I feel like Steve Jobs and his campaign to kill Android, that's why they dropped Maps in the first place, you know?
I can't imagine Steve Jobs recommending a competitor's service.
Right.
So what happened, here's where the Fringer laid out some differences, and here's one more. Steve Jobs stood up there, had a conference, stood up there and held the phone up and said, this happens to all phones. We're no different. Your problem isn't our problem. It's a problem with the way phones are designed. That's what he said.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
he basically it was an example of the reality distortion field. Like, he did not believe that there was a problem, therefore there was not a problem.
Yeah, and ignore the fact that they changed the antennas later. You know, whatever.
There's a problem, but it's just not his fault. You know what I mean? And I think part of it's because he was tired of people saying, well, the iPhone has a bad antenna because the first one had bad Wi-Fi due to the aluminum back. The second one and third ones, AT&T had a problem, but they were like, when we make the fourth one, we're going to make it with the antenna on the outside so that it's clearly not our fault. But shit, we over-designed it. It didn't work right necessarily. So hearing all this shit for 3 years, I make my fourth one. I thought I beat this problem, and lo and behold, everyone's complaining about it. So now I'm pissed, and I'm going to say it's everybody's fault, not just my fault. That was Steve Jobs. Whereas Tim Cook was like, this is empirical. Look at these, like the amount of blogs that showed up, the really funny mistakes that were made in the mapping application. Incontrovertible evidence, preponderance of evidence that this was just not the same standard that it was before. And Tim Cook did, I think what he's done something like this before where he writes the email and he sends it out and that's that. There's nothing to say except for the fact that, oh, boo-hoo, Apple was wrong. There's just nothing to say. So there's no reason to try to like defend it and have a whole big hullabaloo because that's already happened and happening. He's the author that calms everybody down. Like, guys, here's an alternative.
And this shows how his brain works. Like, he is the operations guy. He's the guy who streamlined Apple's business so they wouldn't have inventory just sitting around. Right. And they ended up making a lot of money because of that. So this is sort of like a great measured response that we probably wouldn't have seen from Jobs. Yeah, so it's interesting though, because I feel like even this solution is kind of crappy, because I was trying to find public transit directions to somewhere in New Jersey for a potential concert. There are so many apps out there now, and none of them have the right stuff. I kind of do miss the day when I could just open up Maps and be like, hey, take me here, and Maps is like, all right.
Well, that's why you have an iOS 5 device just lying around your house, because even if you can't walk around with it, at least you can look something up.
Well, apparently Google's going to release Street View and some other stuff in the web version of Google Maps tomorrow. So that's going to get a little better, at least. Yeah.
And I mean, the Latitude application that's there, they can replace that with any new mapping application that they want. You know what I mean? Like, they can... The big thing for me that's interesting is if Google does drop a new app, and we all think it's going to happen at the end of the year, if they drop a fully new app, it's actually going to hurt Apple's Maps app even more. Because as people adopt the Google app, Google's getting all that location data and looking for what people are searching and going to locations. And that's going to continue to fuel their ability to have accurate traffic, accurate data. It's all about usage. Usage is what – when people started using maps in 2007, the number of people using maps was lower, but it had a nice, like, you know, rolling stone effect, snowballing effect, so that they were able to make the experience better without having to touch Apple's actual application, because it's just the data that's pulling from. The data got better. If Apple doesn't have access to those users on the same grand scale, it's going to take longer for them to hit the same standard.
Here's a weird twist to the whole Apple map situation. MacRumors is reporting that Apple is piloting a program to tap into its vast number of retail store employees to help improve the company's new maps on iOS 6. Multiple sources indicate that... What's that?
The ones they wanted to fire last
well,
month.
It's weird. The multiple sources have indicated that the participating stores will dedicate 40 hours of staff time per week distributed amongst a number of employees to manually examine Apple's mapping data in the areas in their areas and submit corrections and improvements. And it's unknown exactly what procedures will be used to examine the data, whether it'll simply be side-by-side comparisons of Google Maps data, or if more sophisticated efforts such as in-person verification will be used. I think this is a really weird... I mean, it's kind of like saying, you know, if Burger King said, our burgers taste awful, we're going to leave it up to the fry cooks to decide, you know, how to fix that problem.
It's a data collection thing, and the only crowdsourced army they have are these employees. And they're going to be able to use the employees of the Apple Store they're not the most technically awesome people, but they are technically savvy and they take direction well. So I feel like layout that... Okay, walk around the block, you know, use whatever, check in here, check in there, all that stuff. Maybe they'll have access to a separate app that helps them edit or throw in suggestions for data. I mean, I don't know how many app stores, I don't know how many employees are at per app store, but they have plenty of app stores. They're not app stores, you know, physical stores, retail stores. And I really feel as if they're going to be able to, if they can leverage them correctly. So people who are at the top who are thinking about this carefully, if they can leverage this army of people correctly, they can get some significant data. What they could think about doing is talking to our friends at Foursquare, looking at where people, you know, pay for some data. Foursquare wants money. Foursquare's open for business. Pay for the data and say, look, we're trying to we want to know where people are checking in, because we're going to add that data to augment the Yelp data that we have. The tips are in there, so people can use those tips. You can get all this kind of crowdsourced significant data out of that I think, frankly, is more dynamic than how Yelp works, because Yelp is still mostly a desktop situation. So if they tied in with Foursquare, we'd see some real growth there. But I think this is a good second choice.
Davinder, what do you think about this move on Apple's part?
I mean, it kind of makes sense. At this point, they need all the help they can get, right, guys? Like, that's pretty much it. They either need to buy, like, some mapping company that already has a lot of this stuff settled, or they kind of just have to work hard and figure this out. And keep building it. Even if Apple bought something, it would still take them, like, a year to kind of put it all together and implement it. So it's kind of a shame. It's, like, despite how much I like the iPhone 5, it's still, to me, like, a great smartphone. It's just too bad that the maps kind of suck.
I'm reminded of Louis C.K. You know, on like the Tonight Show or like the Conan Show or whatever,
about.
Where he's like, "Give it a minute, it's going to space." Like, at the end of the day, we still have a handheld computer that's literally going to space with a GPS signal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's assisted by cell phone towers, but it's going to space and returning where you are on a map. And the stuff that's off. Yeah, it's off, but it's
all
it's
first
not
world
stable.
That's a different argument, though. That's an argument for when, like, you know, your GPS is taking too slow. This is more like it is going to space and sending you into the East River, and that seems like worthy
I get, of complaint. I'm not discounting it. I'm not throwing it out there. I'm just saying is that, like, it's a funny problem for us to have. It makes sense given our lifestyle and everything.
Yeah.
But when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, you're like, okay, it is going to space. Like, can I do any better personally?
Nope. It's, you know, our technology is supposed to move forward. We're not supposed to be taking giant leaps backwards. It's not how this works. How are we ever going to get to the singularity if we keep doing this?
According to the Wall Street Journal, who is almost never wrong about these kind of things, Asian suppliers for Apple have started mass production of a new tablet computer smaller than the current iPad. They quote executives at component makers as having said. The smaller tablet will have 7.85-inch LCD display with a lower resolution than the latest iPad. The screen on the current iPad measures 9.7 inches diagonally. And so there we go. That's basically – we've been hearing rumors that this is coming for
a
while.
The only thing I heard that's different was 7.85 versus 7.83.
So, I mean, this is all – it's all
– R2 agrees.
The Verge reports that Microsoft is preparing to launch its Xbox Music service on October 26th. Multiple sources familiar with Microsoft's plan have confirmed the new service will launch at the same time as Windows 8. They'll have subscriptions like the current Zune Music Pass offering. I think they should change that name, too. They'll be available alongside a free streaming service supported by ads similar to Spotify, and the service will be available on Windows Phone, Windows 8, and Xbox 360. A key part of the service is Microsoft SkyDrive integration, which allows users to store music and playlists in a cloud collection across multiple devices. So there we go on that. That sounds like a I can't wait for that to I mean, that'll be a nice addition to Windows 8 in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can and it's also interesting too that they're managing to do this before Apple gets their thing out.
Does Microsoft So here's a question I have about Microsoft and their Zune brand.
Yeah.
It seems like Zune is sort of halfway between something that Microsoft is trying to kill off and something that they're trying to not kill off. And I feel like they need to decide, like, what are they going to do their music under?
You're expecting Zune, that's fine. Internal logic, Chris, from Microsoft, and it's that's not going to happen.
No, I know. I'm just pointing out, like...
Yeah, I have a Zune HD, guys. I still use it almost every day. I really like it. But at this point, I'm actually, whenever I land the iPhone 5, I'm just going to go for the 64 gig version because I'm like... You know what? It's time. It's time to move on. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Wait, whenever you land it? What do you mean whenever you land it?
Whenever I can actually find it. Have you tried buying a new iPhone recently?
Oh, I think
remember we talking last week about how they only sold 5 million units because they only had 5 million units to sell?
Yeah, sort of.
So you have an iPhone 5
now? No, I have a review unit. I have a review unit. It's not mine.
So, Devendra, you have some news about T-Mobile and MetroPCS.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think yesterday or a couple... No, yesterday, it was rumored that Deutsche Telekom and MetroPCS, Deutsche owns T-Mobile, it was rumored that they were in talks about kind of combining. MetroPCS is really big on its prepaid service. They're actually pretty large as well. And T-Mobile kind of needs some help. They're losing subscribers. They need more spectrum and all sorts of fun stuff. So this morning, they confirmed that this deal is happening. MetroPCS is going to get $1.5 billion from Deutsche Telekom from this. Deutsche Telekom is going to own 74% of the combined company. And it's also really interesting, too, because it's a reverse merger. And I had to look this up today. So apparently, T-Mobile was never a publicly traded company in America. It was just always because Deutsche Telekom was the parent company, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But MetroPCS is publicly traded. So it seems like MetroPCS is going to absorb T-Mobile, and somehow that will turn T-Mobile into a public company. So it's weird how this is happening because Metro is smaller, going to be absorbing this bigger
Metro
carry.
Absorbs T-Mobile.
But it's still going to be called T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, like, you know, they basically it's a buyout, so they're going to be they're buying the controlling interest in Metro. They're moving their operations under Metro's rules, and then Metro's going to change its name to T-Mobile. So it's actually the T-Mobile leadership, but it's kind of like in a Metro shell that will
sort
soon
of.
Become,
I mean, yeah, because Deutsche is still going to be ruling everything, so Metro basically has no more say over anything. Really,
it's like
so
what happened Metro. It's exactly what happened to Continental United. Bought controlling interest in Continental, and they basically like are using a lot of Continental's like resources and stuff, but it's all United running it. And if you notice, the icon is it still says United, but the icon is Continental, and there's a lot of aspects of Continental that are still there in order to get it done. But that's where the reverse merger comes on.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Is I was under the impression that MetroPCS mostly was paying other providers for their spectrum and everything. I was impressed they didn't own their own spectrum. Is this?
They apparently have quite a bit.
No,
I thought that too. They're not just an MVNO. They have legit spectrum and stuff.
Oh, I did not know that. That's cool. That's really going to help them. Honestly, it's really nice to see something exciting happen. You know, honestly, like the biggest problem with both MetroPCS and Deutsche Telekom up until this, or sorry, T-Mobile up until this point has just been that they're too small. Like, I don't know anyone who's has complaints about MetroPCS or T-Mobile. And honestly, awesome. T-Mobile usually wins for best service, really good phones. Like, well, not as much anymore, but for a while at least, it was pretty good. Like, and it'll be nice to see a third player actually, or a fourth player in this, I guess, really sort of seriously join the smartphone race.
Our last headline of the week, a federal judge on Monday ended a sales ban on the Samsung Galaxy 10.1. Judge Lucy Koh issued the injunction in June based on the likelihood that a jury would find that a specific Apple design patent had been infringed. Although the jury largely sided with Apple in the case, the jury did find that Samsung's tablet infringed on that particular product. The sole basis for that injunction no longer exists. At the same time, Samsung also submitted an amendment to a lawsuit originally filed in April against Apple, adding the iPhone 5 to a list of devices that includes the iPhone 4, 4S, iPad 2, and new iPad that Samsung accuses of infringing on several Samsung patents. Before we move into our main topic here, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to recommend just came out this week on Audible. And it's Makers, the New Industrial Revolution by Chris Anderson, who is a Wired magazine editor. And he's previously authored a couple of books. And this book takes you to the front lines of a new industrial revolution as today's entrepreneurs using open source design and 3D printing bring manufacturing to the desktop. In an age of custom fabricated do-it-yourself product design and creation, the collective potential of a million garage tinkerers and enthusiasts is about to be unleashed, driving a resurgence of American manufacturing. A generation of makers using the web's innovative innovation model will help drive the next big wave in the global economy as the new technologies of digital design and rapid prototyping gives everyone the power to invent, creating the long tail of things. I felt that this was an appropriate book to choose for this week's discussion. And this particular book can be yours by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Or you can choose one of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles, plus the 30-day trial to check out their service. And if you don't like the service, you can still keep the book afterwards. So there we go. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music before we get into our main topic. So take a listen to this and come on back.
There is nothing that competes with heaven. And I know it's not killing. Yeah, I could make a killing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Duane DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor. And let's talk about some of the minefields, the legal minefields of 3D printing. I'm going to start with this story that was reported in Wired this week about Cody Wilson, who planned in the coming weeks to make and test a 3D printed pistol. And those plans had been put on hold as the company that he was using, whose device he was using to print, Stratasys, pulled the lease on the printer that he had rented for his project, which is called WikiWeapon. Mm-hmm. He says, they came for it straight up. I didn't even have it out of the box. He had leased the printer earlier in September, and he had a group online that had raised $20,000 to help fund this project. He was aiming to provide a platform for anyone to share 3D weapon schematics online. And Stratasys pulled the lease. And he said that basically Stratasys's policy said that it's the policy of Stratasys not to knowingly allow its printers to be used for illegal purposes. Wilson said that nothing that he does violates the law. It is in fact legal in the U.S. to manufacture a gun at home without a license, provided it's not for sale or trade. But it doesn't include all weapons. Machine guns and sawed-off shotguns are illegal to manufacture. And also there's a law against creating a weapon other than a pistol or a revolver capable of being concealed on the person. So there are some kind of legal loopholes, but apparently, I mean, it was Stratasys' decision whether or not to allow him to use their device, regardless of what the legality is. But I thought that this whole issue kind of brings up in a subject that we really haven't talked about, which is, you know, you can.
What's life like with a replicator in your house? That's what we're talking about.
And the big thing here whatever is that, you can dream.
Yeah whatever you
these
can
guys,
dream.
It doesn't matter whether it's actually illegal or not. When you're a company that is, you know, it's got investors, it's got like leadership, it's got PR to think about, you are not going to want to be the company who's responsible for the next mass shooting in the U.S. because someone took your design, printed it out, and took someone out. Forget the law at this point. This is clearly about responsibility.
So what was their relationship in the first place? I mean, why did he have one? Was it promotional? Was it like a renting agreement? Like exactly.
Like it was a lease. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, but you know what? If he did this with a MakerBot thing, like whenever that thing gets complicated enough, they can't just come and take it. If you bought it, you know, this doesn't solve the greater problem.
Right.
So, yeah. It's good for right now because of their model, but it's sort of not.
Yeah. So it's not good for a few,
the question is, where do the lines get drawn, and are we responsible for the things that we print on our own? I mean, we're not talking about
like what is that even about? You're responsible. Yeah. You're beholden to how you use materials in this world. And you're responsible. Like people who have arsenals in their houses, whether they built them on a 3D printer, they got them on a 3D printer, they machined them themselves, or they bought them at stores, that's just not okay. So, yes.
Sure, but I'm not even talking about just dangerous items. Now, here's another example. I remember a while back, Paramount Pictures issued a cease and desist to someone who was distributing 3D blueprints to generate prop Argus cubes from the movie Super 8. Remember that movie?
Yeah.
And those big cubes. Not someone who was selling the prop cubes themselves. They were just distributing for free the plans to print them at home.
Well, that's a problem too, because you're distributing, it's like I'm distributing an MP3. I'm taking something that you designed that is your IP and I'm distributing it. Even when we do contracts in my office, when we're talking about creative and everything like that, you can't use what we give you to sell it, to make a profit off of, or to give it away for free, because that's our work product. And the idea that you can copy and paste it, whether it's a hardware thing from a 3D printer or
an asset that is a digital one that you can copy and paste, the fact is that distribution has always been under a certain level of prohibition in this country because of our IP laws. So they have totally the right to do that.
Yeah, it's sort of it's an interesting philosophical question, I think, because it sort of really brings up a deeper question of what it means to own something and to own, you know, not just, you know, the distribute the actual thing, but distribute the you know, the ability to recreate it. I mean, you could argue that an MP3 is not the song. MP3 is a series of instructions that enables the computer to recreate something that sounds like the song, which is, you know, parsing hairs. But at the same time, I mean, that's exactly what
the CDs too. But in the end, a spade is a spade. It's kind of like when the when the judges are saying, I don't, you know, there's porn and there's art. I can tell the difference, right? Like the idea is that like you can. When you buy a CD, you don't own the music. You own the right to play the music on that CD. That's why the MP3 thing got so big. It's the same thing with the film, same thing with everything. So the fact is, it's outside of the license. You're always given a license. And if things happen outside of that, they have the right to say stop.
Yeah, now the more interesting thing, I think, is the fact that like we've seen with the digital revolution that the changes in technology have the ability to drive changes in culture. Like, regardless of who wins up winning the legal particular battles about, you know, file sharing and everything, I think it's pretty clear that an entire generation, if not two generations of people from like the 90s onward, has grown up with a very different conception of what it means to own music or movies than their parents did. And that really drives a very different approach in how they think about that. And I think that this has the possibility to drive the same thing.
I don't know if they have a different perception of what owns it. They just had more ability in terms of what they could do with what they had. I don't think your parents had a record, and if someone made a tape, they were like, oh my God, you don't own that. You're such a bootlegger. I think it was, you know, there was a lot less of that and more like, oh, it's so much harder to get that done that I'm not even going to try to do it. I think there's always been a question of like, what the hell is this IP stuff? It's not like the most tangible thing ever. We just have more ability today to do what we want with this material. And I think when it comes to the – when you know, in music and movies and other digital assets, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, okay, you get why there's a big issue. Like you get how nebulous the issues can be around that, because like, can you really hold it? Can you really do it? Obviously some work went into it. It's not your work, whatever. When you get to the stuff with the 3D printing, it's really interesting because whereas with the digital stuff, the material that you're using to hold this new stuff is your hard drive space, the material that you're using, you're actually investing in the metal that's going to be zapped by or refined by the 3D printer or zapped by the laser or whatever. So like you kind of actually do have more ownership in that. In this case, it becomes in some ways even more abstract because it is the design and the design alone. So it's really... Yeah. I think you're right that this is really nebulous, but I do think that it's one of those things that people have struggled with conceptually for quite some time, and the ability to actually use it is now what's on the face of things. And when you're saying about culture, like I do look to Star Trek, and the joke I made about the replicator, that's a joke, but at the same time, in the Star Trek universe, because matter can be generated from all these crazy stores of power that they have. You know, that replicator, that 3D printer that they have, it's not about who owns what. It's just about the fact that there's no limitation of resources. Therefore, we don't have to worry about, you know, using someone else's design and copying it. So much so that everyone uses reference designs to make their own stuff, that kind of thing. So if we get to a point where we've just got matter everywhere, then yay. Yeah. And we can like hold it to whatever shape. It becomes less of an issue. But right now, where resources are relatively constrained, people are like, that's mine. That's my thought. That's my idea. And honestly, the innovation aspect of America has been very much in the ownership and manipulation of such thoughts and ideas.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys this. How long do you think it'll be until you get some sort of 3D printer? Because they're really getting down there. And the new MakerBot is really nice. Yeah, and we're building.
How much does it run for? Just out of curiosity.
It's over $2,000 now. It's actually more expensive than the old MakerBot. I think it's around $2,300. But you don't have to build it. It's kind of all self-contained. It's like an actual product now. So they're getting down to the point of like what desktop computers used to cost in the 90s or something, the late 90s.
There's a recent Kickstarter project called the Form 1, and the Form 1, if you look at what they're proposing, has a much higher resolution than the MakerBot. And,
right.
And they're asking for $26.99 if it's not a limited, mm-hmm. you know, the early backers got theirs for $22.99. But I mean, yeah. this looks like the next stage in evolution of the
if they can make it. I'm getting kind of tired of Kickstarter campaigns promising the world. But if they can do it, I definitely want
to
see it.
Yeah, Tavinja, you're right. Oop came out to me with an email this morning, basically saying you only have 10 days to tell us where you live, or else you won't get it, even though you backed it. And I was like, what?
Just give them your address.
No, I gave it to them and everything, but it's like on some level, you know, I get most of my stuff delivered to my workplace. But you know, we're a growing company. We've taken up a lot of the space in the building. And what if we do leave? What if we do move to a different address? But I've got to think about where the company might physically be in March. You know, because of the pipeline, the railroad, the road to get the Ouya is just so long in terms of months. You buy something from Amazon, it's there a couple days later. You buy something from other places, it might take a back order of 2 months or whatever. But, you know, that Ouya, that's a significant amount of time.
That's a whole other issue about what your expectations are of Kickstarter projects. Are you expecting it to be a store, or are you expecting it to be backing a project where the end result is you also get a reward, a physical reward for that backing that project?
Well, I think it's twofold. What I'm saying is I don't like the fact that I understand that it's going to take a while for these things to come to fruition, and that's why I back them. I believe that they will happen. What I don't want is for someone to show up and say, boom, give me your email address, give me your physical address within 10 days or else you'll never get it. That's not a barrier to them fulfilling the stuff. You know, they've made $8 million. They should be able to pull it off given their specifications. So coming up to me and saying, boom, you know, I need your address. And then also, like, why are they asking for it now when the device won't be ready until March? They should be asking for the address sometime closer to the launch date, because I can't tell you what my best address will be in March. Even when it comes to where I live, I might move by March. I might be in a different location in Boulder by March. That's the problem.
Yeah. Kickstarter is really good for validating ideas, which is important, but it sort of shows you why, like, investors don't invest in companies just on ideas. Investors want to invest in a company based on the team, based on their ability to actually execute the idea. And all
maybe
Kickstarter
why investors
really
don't invest in hardware too, you know.
No, yeah, I agree. I mean, it solves one problem, i.e. ensuring that there is market demand for whatever hardware it is you're going to create. That's certainly an important thing, which has not been possible to do before this. At the same time, there is, you know, another problem. You have tons of people who are investing essentially in products without any idea of who the team is, who's going to build it, what have they done before, are they actually able to do this, or are they just simply pulling in a lot of money and being like, oh yeah, it didn't work. You know, we had a really nice vacation to Florida instead. I don't know. To answer your question, Anthony, I don't know. I see myself probably getting one in the next like 5 years at least. Yeah. I mean, at the moment, I'm super busy, but you know what I think of this for? Legos. All those sets that I, like, have lost one piece on and, like, or, like, that I want to make a custom piece. Uh-huh. There's actually a really sort of fairly vibrant custom Lego world online of custom minifigs, mm-hmm. custom pieces that don't exist in the regular Lego thing. And this is a spectacular, like, basically ability to add on to that platform.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of, you know, build the things you always wanted to build but never could, you know.
And there's even a great project out there called a Free Universal Construction Kit, which distributes a printable matrix of adapter bricks that will enable complete interoperability between Lego, Kinex, Bristle Blocks, Lincoln Logs, and Tinker Toys. They will distribute the plans, and they're doing this on Thingiverse. And there are sites like Thingiverse, Shapeways, and Pirate Bay has a category called Fizzables that distribute CAD plans specifically for use in 3D printers. But the question is, I mean, these are great projects, but how long are they going to be legal before somebody comes in and jumps on them for violating IP?
It's like the early Napster days, right?
Fourth round it. That's the question. They may not be legal right now. I think the thing about it is, you know, I see 3D printers coming up as embedded devices supported by a company like Apple, where you pay that dollar for that Lego piece, right?
Yeah.
You pay 25 cents for a Lego piece, and then it draws you the Lego piece because you have the stuff, the material to make it. I think that's where they have to go if they want to maintain, if the people who are making these products want to maintain their revenue and everything. Yeah. That's really kind of what you have to think. Like, there's no such thing as a free lunch, guys. Like, yeah, people, the resources that go into the cool stuff that we like cost money. And we have to figure out models that have to pay for that money. For me, I think 5 years is a great timeline for a 3D printer that I don't have to think about. I want an appliance. I don't want to have to tinker with it necessarily. That kind of thing. So I feel
like 5 years. That makes me kind of sad, Wayne, because you're the sort of person that wants to build your own computer. So I feel like you want a certain amount of tinkering. But I feel like the new MakerBot is really nice because it's kind of just an all-in-one device. You don't have to build it. You can kind of just plug it in and get it working, install the software and all that stuff. So it's like the Mac to the early, it is more Altairs. Like a self-contained Mac to the earlier computers of the makers.
To hold all my my data in RAID, but it's like, I prefer Drobo because I know that someone's backing it. When it comes to my own computer, I know those systems well enough so that I can like fix it if I need to. And frankly, when it comes to, I can probably do that better than some of the Windows machine makers right now. I understand Microsoft's products and how they work, and I know what I need to do to get it. But when it comes to some of this more specialized stuff, especially I need the warranty. I need to know that if it's working, someone else.
Yeah.
What frustrates me most about this whole situation is that it feels to me like this whole. We're in the early days, the wild, wild west of desktop printing. And it feels to me like this is analogous to the whole mashup phenomenon where, we're at a point here where, in a way, Dwayne is right. Everything we may be wanting to do with this may be illegal. And if all of a sudden they decide to enforce this, we're in a situation where we can't print whatever we want to.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like
you can make music on. Well, I think you got to look at it slightly differently. You can't print whatever copyrighted stuff you want to, but computers today have allowed independent artists to make their own music without having to deal with big studios. I think it can be said of people who want to do things like, and independent software makers with the mobile stuff have been able to thrive as well without having to, games are all over these iOS devices and Android devices, whereas before you had to be a game company that had an in with right? So
I hear what you're saying, Dwayne, but I think fundamentally it's going to be a little different too. Like all these makers, all these 3D printers are definitely going to spur on all sorts of new innovation, but like the gun thing. Like I feel like we're going to see limitations on what not just like copyrighted materials, but like what sort of things you can actually build with these machines, because eventually it's going to get to be the point where people are trying to come up with bomb schematics or something, like an easy way to put a bomb together using a 3D printer and just pour stuff in. There's going to be things, I feel like these things just kind of have to stop people from doing. It's like putting porn on YouTube or something. There are going to be restrictions as we are building things, just like we're building content on the internet. The same restrictions will probably end up applying. So
I have to think about this kind of thing on the same front as I'm responsible. I don't want people to get hurt by my product, but also on the I'm responsible. I don't want my brand to be destroyed when some guy
is
just talking about. So there is incentive, Andy, for people to try to find ways to prohibit activities that might be a detriment to the whole entire 3D printing community. What if they all just get banned because people are up in arms because there was an Oklahoma City type disaster, God forbid, based on a 3D printer? That's the kind of group scare, group think is what got us in all these wars, and we got the Patriot Act passed, and that kind of thing is what'll get them. If we don't watch out, if we don't have regulations, we end up with situations like the spamming problem of the 90s, right? That was just email. It didn't ruin anyone's life, but that's what happened when people are in this wild, wild west, and when you can actually make material that can affect other people's lives.
And you have like all the P2P companies that tried to start and tried to rely on having freely traded software, and they all kind of fell apart eventually.
Although you guys are basing your, I mean, so the reason why I guess I think it's definitely a danger that there could be restrictions put in here by incumbent people who are worried about this encroaching on them. But I think one huge difference here, which makes that almost tragic in a way, is that I don't see this in material terms as being as much of a threat to traditional manufacturers as peer-to-peer sharing was to the music industry. The music industry essentially works off of owning the distribution channel for this intellectual copyright. Whereas, like, let's face it, I mean, we're comparing building a maker thing to Dwayne building his own computer. Dwayne is an exception to the rule. Like, people don't want to build their own computers. People don't even want to customize their own computer. They want pre-made. And even if something, you know, is purely available easily on the internet, and even if it's cheaper, like, are you going to build every single individual part for that action figure that you want, or are you just going to get the thing in the store for like $5? And also, I mean, just the economies of scales that they're able to hit. Like, even if the machines themselves end up becoming very cheap, you still have to pay for the plastic.
Sure.
Absolutely. You know, that's
– it's like you can't
– I just don't see this as being really a material threat to them. No matter how good it gets, it's just – it's not going to eat the manufacturer's lunch the way that I feel like peer-to-peer sharing did. But I think that they're going to be afraid that it's going to, and they're going to push back against it.
It's incremental growth. Like Microsoft, for instance, lost a lot with Windows incrementally. Half the people using Windows – I'm exaggerating. I don't know the actual number. But a lot of people using Windows just had a copy of it up until Windows needed that full activation in Windows 7 or whatever. Windows Vista, whatever, whichever one was the first one that implemented that. Same with Adobe. They don't want to lose that specific that level of incremental growth. They want every single penny, especially in an economy that – you know, still hasn't risen to where it was in 2008 by consumer spending. So they do want to think about that kind of thing. And I do think that what we're really going to see out of these 3D printers are small people being able to develop concepts and prototypes in their houses and then move those prototypes to bigger manufacturing processes, whether it's in China or Brazil or even here in America. And that's the real space where these things are going to grow. I think they're going to like take over like, you know, some copyrighted material. But I do think that people who are copyright holders, they're going to have the benefit of learning from what happened with software and other IP-based issues. And they're going to apply those to their hard issues. And yeah, I think that's – cool.
I'm not sure about the manufacturing side of things, but in terms of like when I want one of these things, I think, Chris, you were talking about Legos. You know what? Like, forget Legos. Like, just having a device that can create anything, you can design it on your computer. I imagine, like, by the time I have kids or something, this will be the best thing in the world. Like,
open source toys.
You can create anything. Like, your imagination will be your only limit at that point. And I think that's going to be kind of fascinating. So not only like Lego blocks, but you could design your own action figures. You could design whatever the heck you want. This is like creation that we've never had before.
Right.
You could design your own blocks, your own block system. You could design your own all in all in all. And that's where it gets exciting. It gets exciting when your kids are sitting there and something that is like AutoCAD or some other amazing design program running on a 14 gigahertz chip with like 85 terabytes of RAM. And they're not limited the way we felt limited. They don't have to hit like submit and then walk away from the computer forever, because they can have this instant gratification that allows them to screw up the way we've learned how to use cameras today. You know, remember like when you had a camera and your parents like lent you the camera to take some pictures? Oh no, that's too much. Whatever, you got to wait for a week to get it back to see how well you did. The ability for us to take these digital shots has made our photography better. The ability for us to create physical stuff in these 3D printers with the raw materials and just the designs coming out of our heads is going to make all design better. So I think it's going to be – you're going to see like companies like Apple, obviously they already have 3D printers. They're going to, you know, they're going to happen at that wider scale. And we're going to see innovation happen across all sorts of fields if this is treated and shepherded correctly.
So one of the things that really excites me with this, and I've sort of learned a little bit more about what it's like to run a manufacturing company. So we share office space with a company called SlidePad that makes a special type of bicycle brake. And one thing that I sort of didn't appreciate until I talked to them is like just how much prototyping they have to do. Like one of their guys essentially does nothing except prototype and refine their design, and he has to build every single prototype, and that's fairly laborious process even for something as simple, you know, relatively speaking, as a bicycle brake. You know, there's two or three or four parts to it, and then each one needs to be machined, each one needs to be, you know, designed. And like that makes, you know, doing a hardware startup in fairly difficult, and hardware, you know, very difficult to sort of get something off the ground before you go to the main manufacturing. This is sort of like the Ruby on Rails of hardware manufacturing. Sure. Something to get you off the ground really quickly, and then you can migrate to something more powerful when you need it. And that, I think that along with Kickstarter, you know, as we talked about, is a really, really exciting thing in terms of the world of hardware startups, and just hardware in general, to sort of to have a whole new sort of set of physical devices and physical objects that we can play with. I suppose also for just like one-off stuff that just, you know, would not be possible before.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely would like to play around with these things. $2,000 is a little bit expensive for a toy at this point.
Adoption rate will drive down the prices, and you know, eventually basically it'll come to down where the problem that we're having isn't the cost of the printer, but the cost of the medium. The just like with regular printers, it'll be the cost of the ink, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Before we close off tonight, Chris, you have some exciting news for us, don't you?
Yeah, so we announced today that Startup Digest, the company that I work for almost exactly the last year, was acquired today by an organization called Startup Weekend up in Seattle. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Startup Weekend, but they have this event that they put on called Startup Weekend, which is basically a 54-hour marathon where people get together in a space and they divide up into teams, and the object is in a single weekend to start a company, come up with a minimum viable product, market it, basically get your initial thing off the ground. And they do about 300 or 400 events like this worldwide. It's about 5 or 10 a week around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of have a really big sort of connection with the world startup community. And they sort of approached us, and we decided that Startup Digest, the newsletter, would be a really sort of good fit with them. It's sort of always been something that we really cared about the content on, and we really sort of resisted covering it with ads, which would have been sort of the logical way to monetize it. And so they're a nonprofit organization. So it seems like a sort of nonprofit-y sort of thing to do to give back to the community. So we sold it off, and now Chris and I are going to sort of take the software that I wrote for Startup Digest, and we are creating a company called GroupTie, which is going to be a sort of group management application.
Nice. And, kill Yammer, man. Yeah. Kill it. Seriously.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was not crazy. I'm sorry that I couldn't tell you guys about it earlier. There were embargoes and everything, but it was pretty exciting. Hmm?
So you guys are going to start your own company called GroupTie out of some of the collaborative efforts from the merger between Startup Weekend and Startup Digest.
Yeah, essentially. GroupTie is going to have sort of some of the assets that we had, sort of essentially me and some of the software that I wrote for it and Chris. But yeah, GroupTie is pretty much going to be an entirely separate thing. Yeah. It's kind of crazy.
And this is something you're doing on your own, GroupTie.
Yeah, so yeah, we're doing GroupTie as a company. It's a little bit more complicated in the details because Startup Weekend is a nonprofit and we're for a profit, and there are all sorts of extra funky stuff happening there. But the basic gist of it is that Startup Digest will now be living in Startup Weekend's care, and Chris and I are still going to be curators of the Silicon Valley newsletter, but not anything more than that in sense of sort of official capacity. And I'm really excited to be working on GroupTie because it solves a problem which I have struggled with for much of my professional career. Namely, there are all these groups that we are part of, like our alumni groups and our school groups, and yet it's not nearly as easy, I think, as it should be to leverage those groups and meet people within your circles that you don't know are in your circles, but you want to meet. So we have a couple of like alumni interested in us and some professional societies. And you should go to our website. We have a really kind of amazing set of people that are already interested in beta testing it. Stanford Graduate School of Business, the Thiel Foundation, and Startup Weekend themselves are interested in using the software platform. So I'm going to be nose to the wheel coding for probably the next few months again. But it's kind of exciting to have it all pay off and to find a good home for it and have a really exciting next thing to be doing.
That's terrific. That's nice. Congratulations.
Of something, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. So I've sort of been upgraded, I guess, in this process. And I really enjoy working with Chris and Brendan. It's been a really awesome year. Like, I can't believe it's been only a year since I joined them. And yet at the same time, it's been a year. And crazy.
Startup Weekend is losing their CFO to GroupTie, or that he's going to moonlight between GroupTie and Startup Weekend?
He's going to be working with us. He was their former CFO, Startup Weekend. And they have a new CFO who's coming in to replace him.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, congratulations on that. Hopefully all the nose to the grindstone coding on GroupTie won't – hopefully you can take lift your head up at least once a week to join us on the drill down.
Yeah. I plan on still being pretty involved with the drill down and everything. So no worries there. I think it's important to – sort of talk about startups sort of from the trenches, so to speak. That was sort of always our original idea with the Symbiotic podcast, was to have technical pundits who are actually doing tech rather than, just sort of talking about it.
That's what I love about this group.
Key thing. I mean, you still think about this group. Devinger is covering all these new startups. Yeah. I'm in Boulder. I'm living in the startup world. I'm working at a startup. Chris is starting his own. And then Andy just kind of wraps us all together with a nice, clean candy shell. and I really feel like that's what makes this situation interesting and different.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Devendra. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the drill down?
Sure, you can find me writing about tech every day at VentureBeat.com. I also podcast about movies and TV at /film.com. Everything else I do is at Devendra.org.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you on the intertubes?
You can hit me up at flavors.me/DwayneD. That's my the site that kind of has a link to everything I do. flavors.me/DWAYNED. And obviously, I'm at Twitter. I'm Dwayne D. So just hop on twitter.com/DwayneD, and I'm there. And then there's always gplus.to/DwayneD. Hang out with a lot of guys who talk about Android. As you would imagine, on the Google's social network, and it's a lot of fun. So, that's where you'll find me.
And Chris, how about you? Is it GroupTie now, or?
Yeah, certainly. If you run an organization and you're interested in software to help you manage it and help your group members better connect with each other, certainly check out GroupTie. It's in sort of closed private beta and heavy development right now. But personally, I'm still curating the Startup Digest reading list and events in Silicon Valley at startupdigest.com. And I'm still tweeting at CRISPRnor, and I've relaunched my blog on CRISPRnor.com. So I will actually be having updates to that sort of showing sort of my longer form thoughts on the world.
Terrific. As for myself, you can reach me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan is my Google Plus account. Plus Mr. Babyman, just where I've just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman and you'll find me all over Facebook and Twitter, etc.
Orkut.
I don't think I ever joined Orkut.
Oh, I joined Orkut. Did That's you? My badge of I had to sign up for everything.
I never joined MySpace either, and then they just recently launched a kind of a new relaunch of their service. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscribe link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. And I want to say that if you're listening to us, write us a review on iTunes, on our iTunes account. Tell us how well we're doing or, how poorly we're doing, or we just want to hear from you. You can also write us at comments@thedrilldown.com, or of course you can post a reply in any of the comment threads on the show notes links on geeksofdoom.com. We just want to hear from you. Our show is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us, comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com and we can publish it on our site on The Drill Down. You can let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@TheDrillDown.com for details. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.